This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Welcome to the latest installment, Chicago's Best Ideas. Before we start, I'd tell you a little bit about me, for those of you who don't know me. Todd Henderson is my name. Both my grandfathers were born in horrible poverty. One in a dirt ranch house on the Colorado-Wyoming border. The other in a little village that no one's ever heard of in the mountains outside of Beirut, Lebanon. And I'm sure neither of them could ever have possibly imagined the privileged life that I have led. And a major component of that is standing here at the University of Chicago with all of you. And I just want to say, on a personal note before I start, I'm incredibly grateful every single day that I get to come and do this and be interacting with all of you. So thank you to everybody before I start. I'm here to talk about something completely different today, that is predicting crime. When I watched Professor Case's CBI from a little while ago that was entitled Feminist Fundamentalism, I'm reconsidering the title of this talk, and I was thinking maybe market fundamentalism would be a better title. Professor Case said she has an uncompromising commitment to women's equality, and similarly, I have an uncompromising commitment to the expansion of free markets, and that's what this is about. These could be our heroes for today's talk. If what we want to do is have policymakers have a better idea of how to decide when crime is going to happen so that they can allocate budgetary resources where crime is likely to happen and knowing what kinds of crime are likely to happen, then we might turn to Agent Atherton and Agatha here from the movie Minority Report, Philip K. Dick science fiction about these guys. Agatha here, she was a child of a drug addict who was given the special ability, precognition, to predict the future. She could see a homicide that was about to happen. A little ball would be etched with the name of the victim and the perpetrator. They would come into this center area and Agent Atherton. The policy response is, I know exactly when a crime is going to happen, and I'm going to go and do it. Going to go and stop the criminal. Policymakers at the federal, state, local level do this all the time. They don't have precogs. We could wish they did. And just as a curious footnote, the movie makes these sort of strange moral claims that poor Agatha here is being abused because she alone has the ability to stop all homicides, but boy, it's not really Kantian of us to keep her submerged in a tank and doped up. It's a little bit of a strange moral commitment, right? I think it's taking Kant to the absolute extreme, so we can put aside those for another CBI talk. But these aren't our heroes. Let me just give you where we're going. I'm going to talk a little bit about how current policymakers predict crime, introduce you to these things called prediction markets, talk about how those can be used to help predict crime, and then at the end we can talk about some design issues. Who's forecasting? Who's trying to predict crime? Well, the federal government, federal crime-fighting budget of more than $20 billion, not only is it how do we allocate FBI and other crime-fighting resources, but how do we set sentencing policies? Do we send drug dealers away for a long time? Do we have a difference between crack and powder cocaine? What about rapists? Should we seek the death penalty for them? All of these kinds of issues are aimed at preventing crime. So just this is the federal budget. You can see here $20 billion in 2008. State government does this as well. State police and crime-fighting resources and public safety are probably the major maximand for Governor Blagojevich and his fellow governors. In Illinois last year, a rough approximation is about $3.25 billion spent on reducing crime. And here in Chicago, last year, about $2 billion spent on public safety, and here in the city we have 14,000 police officers. New York City has over 50,000 police officers, and they have to know what to do every day. Where should they go and where should they focus their efforts? in talking to police officials and commissioners across the country, this is as best as I could get as a list of what they do to forecast crime. First, some trial and error. Well, we've always done this, and then there's a little epsilon, which is we're going to think this is going to happen, so we're going to do a little bit different than we did in the past, and we'll learn from that. This can be useful. Gut instinct. A lot of these guys have been doing, and it's mostly guys, have been doing this for years, and they have a good sense of when things are likely to happen. There's some crude mapping that goes on. So they'll take a map of the city, they'll find the liquor stores, the check cashing stores, the schools, they'll draw little circles around them, they'll plot crimes that have happened, and they'll use those as means to predict what's going to happen in the future. These often include things like weather. There was a recent spur of shootings in Chicago, leaving a bunch of people dead over the weekend a couple weeks ago, and they blamed the weather. People were pent up and really needed to shoot people, but they couldn't because it was too cold outside. So they waited until the spring broke and the crocuses came up, and then, Jesse James. They'll also contact so-called experts, people like me, expert on crime forecasting, but, like me in a suit standing in front of people paying them, who develop models, academic models on crime. Well, there's a couple of variants of these. The first two, beat hot spotting and retrospective hot spotting, are the two most common. And as you can imagine, basically just what I described, you have a map showing police beats and you add in a bunch of data, crimes that have happened, and you sort of look for trends. And it's a very kind of eyeball it. It looks to me like there's more crimes in this beat in the past, so let's just allocate some more, thinking the past will be exactly like the future. Some academic criminologist in England came up with a different approach, prospective hot spotting. Their idea here, and there was an article that was along these lines last Sunday in the New York Times Magazine, or two Sundays ago. The idea is that crime is like a contagion. It's like a virus. It spreads, and crime begets crime. So they said burglaries occur specifically in groups and clusters. Think of like Jack the Ripper and those kinds of things, right? You have sprees of crime. So what they did is they reran history using predictions that had embedded in them this sort of contagion aspect. And what they found is when they reran history, they would have predicted 62% of the burglaries in this one English town within 2 days. And they compared this, found this was much better than the other two techniques. They develop all kinds of maps. This is the same city and the same crime data. This is from a report by this National Institute for Justice, whose function is to help police officers better forecast crime. This is from their appendix, and they give all these. This is exactly the same data, just presented in different ways. The problem with all of this is there's no real uniform standards. There are tons and tons of models that different academics use. There's no consensus about which one of these is the best technique. Should we use standard deviations or quartiles or percentages? What's the best way to process the data from the past about the future? And everybody has their pet theories, from the police commissioner to the academic criminologist at the University of Pennsylvania. Okay. The problem here is there's lots of information. Lots of people have lots of information about when crimes are going to happen. The criminals have information about when crimes are going to happen. Neighbors have information about when crimes are going to happen. They see people loitering around on the street. The cops on the street might know. Doctors in hospitals might see trends in drugs or things that lead them to believe there's an increase in criminality. Academic criminologists at various universities around the world may have different models that they think perform better. The police commissioner, the politicians in the governor's office, everybody has a little bit of information, and there's no mechanism to aggregate it. Normally, we think the best way to aggregate and process dispersed information is through markets. Okay, so what kind of markets could we use to process this dispersed information about the future of crime? This is our real hero. This is F.A. Hayek. He's the gentleman who told us this sort of obvious point about markets. So he's my Agent Atherton. Do you know what I want to know what the weather is for tomorrow? Well, or 6 months from now? You shouldn't ask the weatherman, because they're just guessing. And those computer systems that they have behind them are basically giant coins that they're just flipping to decide whether it's going to rain tomorrow. The people who really know what the weather's going to be are the people buying and selling orange juice futures, because it really matters to them. Ask the farmers, ask the people who profit from the weather, and they'll be able to tell you what the weather's going to be. The space shuttle Challenger exploded, probably before all of you were born, or most of you were born. Do you want to know what caused the explosion of the shuttle Challenger? Well, the government wanted to know, so it convened a blue ribbon panel of NASA scientists and congressmen to sift through all the evidence. And 6 months later, they came to the conclusion that the stock market figured out in a day. Because one of the suppliers, Morton Thiokol, who made the rubber O-ring, they were to blame. And immediately after the disaster, their stock price went into the toilet. Want to know who was going to win the Kentucky Derby? You can see where I'm going. Don't ask the experts. Don't take a poll of the experts. Look at the odds. Horse racing odds are the most accurate predictions in the history of the world. Do you want to know who? How many printers that Hewlett-Packard's going to sell of their new printer? Hewlett-Packard wants to know. They have the same objective function that the police commissioner does. Allocate resources, sales, marketing, engineering, logistics and support to a particular product, but they have to know how many they're going to sell. Well, the old-fashioned way was ask the salespeople, ask the engineers, get everybody around on a conference table and try to decide. And then somebody at Hewlett-Packard had a good idea. Their inspiration, their hero was F.A. Hayek. Let's have a market. Let's give people money, fake money, and have them bet. Just betting. That's all markets are. Betting. Bet on the number of sales of particular printers. So they ran these markets, and it turned out the markets, the market price that are bets about how many printers they're going to sell, vastly outperformed any budget estimates that Hewlett-Packard had made in the past. And remember, in the past, Hewlett-Packard had a strong incentive to get those estimates right. Okay. So here's these prediction markets have come a little bit into fancy. This is from Intrade from about 36 hours ago. The presidential election, 2008 President Obama, Barack Obama to win the 2008 U.S. presidential election. And the last trade was at 55-7. What does that mean? Well, what Intrade has done is they've floated contracts, specifically futures contracts, and there are three at issue here. This contract, Barack Obama to win, pays $1 if Obama wins the presidency in November. And 55.7 is 55.7 cents. And you can see where this is going. That means the market, all of us, believe that Obama's 55.7% likely to win. If you thought he was 80% likely to win, then you should buy at 55 cents because you expect, before you know the resolution, to make 80 cents. Okay, McCain 37 and Clinton 8. So price here is probability. This is also useful. This is from the Oscars. You can see you can trade on all sorts of stuff. Daniel Day-Lewis to win, No Country for Old Men to win the Oscar. And the Hollywood Stock Exchange, where these things are traded, outperforms, you know, Perez Hilton or whoever else is guessing in People magazine who's going to win. Here's some data on the accuracy of these. This is from the Iowa Electronic Markets. They run these for political elections, and you can see 45 degrees is where you want to be. These markets outperform all experts. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to be right all the time. This is the Nirvana fallacy. We're not judging these against God or some omniscient super being. We're judging these against alternative measures of predicting. So here the claim is that markets will outperform experts, not that they're going to get it right all the time. Sometimes a 25-to-1 horse does come in first. Okay, so here you can see in these markets, this is a winner-take-all market for the presidential election. And you can see this is the price of Bush. And as the election comes nearer, the price goes exactly to one, because you only win if Bush wins a dollar. You win a dollar if Bush wins. Another type of market is the vote share market. It doesn't pay a dollar if Bush wins, but instead the objective here is to predict the percentage of the vote that Bush will get. So you can see up until the election it predicts here he's going to get a little bit over 51%. One thing to note on this graph, which we can come back to at the end, is the potential for manipulation, and that's right there, right? Mr. Kerry is slogging along at lower than 50%, and all of a sudden, somebody thought the price rose to 65 cents. This is someone, and these markets are generally pretty low dollar values, trying to manipulate the market to send some sort of signal. I think maybe believing that these had sort of a self-fulfillment capacity, that people would see the markets, thought Kerry was going to lose, and therefore he was more likely to lose. So if I can just move the market and convince the market that Kerry's likely to win, then Kerry would be more likely to win. So I'm going to buy lots of Kerry and drive up the price. Well, whoever that was, and people think it might be George Soros, doesn't know a lot about markets. Because markets can't be fooled, at least over the long run, and no one believed, you know, October 3rd, that Kerry was 65% likely going to win 65% of the vote. So the price, all that did when you raise the price, made it profit opportunities for people who knew that this was just manipulation, and the price fell accordingly. Okay, as I said, why do these markets work better at aggregating information? Well, first of all, markets don't care who you are. They don't care if you're a woman. They don't care if you're a man. They don't care if you're a police sergeant or the commissioner, the governor or some lowly aide, the neighbor or the criminal. They are indiscriminate. They take information from everybody and weigh it not according to your social status or your believed or your perceived intelligence, but according to your confidence. So if you really believe that something's going to happen and you're betting, you can bet proportional to your confidence. You don't get, as if we were taking a poll in this class, everyone would get one vote. But if one person really feels strongly and they have information, private information that others don't have, giving them only one vote is selling their information they can add to the market short. It's also a centralized locus for processing information. So now, as opposed to if you're the governor and you're trying to decide, should we have a death penalty moratorium in Illinois, and what will the effect be on homicide rates? And I could poll lots of people, I could call up lots of police commissioners around the state, I could call up a bunch of experts, but the transactions cost of doing that is incredibly high. The virtue of markets is you pick up the paper every morning, and you're the CEO of General Motors, and you know what, you want to know how General Motors is doing, there's a price right there. You don't have to poll lots of internal experts about the future of General Motors. You don't have to ask all sorts of analysts. You know right there, with one number, up or down, how General Motors is doing. Okay, so just as a quick example, predicting jobs is a classic example of forecasting. The markets really care about how many jobs the United States is going to add every month. Non-farm payrolls is what it's called. And the number of jobs is a sign of the health of the economy. The traditional way that this was done is that we would get a bunch of economists, and you can see all economists look the same. They would all make estimates of their views of the number of jobs. So here you can see the dollar values of their estimates. And we would have some, you know, we'd sum them up and take the average. So here 106,000 jobs. Maybe a better approach would be to get these guys in a room and have them deliberate. That would be an improvement over single point estimates, because maybe economist A here, when he sees that economist B has come up with a lower number, will say, boy, maybe I should reconsider my 100. Maybe there's new information. Maybe I don't know something, and get that person to go back and consider their estimate, right? So one thing to do is just have these individuals deliberate, come up with a single point estimate. Another model is Have these guys participate in a market? The virtue of the market is the price is constantly changing up until the final time, so it's not frozen at some point estimate, either individually or as a group, so new information can be processed. Each of these guys gets more than one vote because they get as many votes as their risk tolerance allows them to bet. And it has the virtue of being very robust. The results from these experiments, so now we take our three examples, each individual point estimates, deliberation as a group, run a market. And the participants are the same six economists predicting jobs. The market does better than the average and any individual point estimate in all of these experiments. Even if it's not like everybody gets to participate in this market, it's the same six guys. Okay, one other preliminary here about conditional prediction markets. Not only can you estimate things like who's going to win the presidential election, but conditional on who wins the presidential election, how will other things turn out? So here is a market on the number of U.S. troops in Iraq on the 30th of June, 2010, if a Democrat is elected president in 2008. This allows you to get an estimate of the market's view about the impact that, say, President Obama will have on our policy in Iraq. And let's say the market shows, you know what? It's going to be the same number of troops. That doesn't mean it's going to be the same number of troops. This isn't perfect forecasting. But what it suggests is that no one believes Obama when he says, I'm going to pull the troops out. Right? People who were betting their own money believe that when Obama sits down in the Oval Office and his peeps come in and say, well, here's the situation on the ground, he's going to fold like a lawn chair. That's what the market's saying. Again, it could be wrong, but that information is at least valuable. Okay. So, predict X given Y, and importantly, if Y doesn't happen, that is, Obama isn't elected president, then you just get your money back. And the in-trade and the for-profit markets do these kinds of conditional markets. So, number of troops, oil price per barrel, stock price of Acme Company, if Skippy is elected to be the CEO. Number of murders in Chicago, if Obama's elected. Now, the problem with this one, and again, this is something I'll talk to at the end if I hurry up, it's a little bit attenuated, right? Obama has a lot of control over this. He doesn't have so much control over this. So if you write these contracts in a way that is full of attenuation, where there's not a lot of great information, you might not get very robust results. Okay, before I turn to the crime, let me just give one example, and that is predicting the flu. The flu has huge effects. 36,000 poor souls die every year in this country from the flu. We spend billions of dollars in prevention. And what we want to know, because we have scarce resources to allocate towards flu prevention, that's just obvious, right, to everybody here, scarcity of resources. How do we allocate these? Do we give them to this part of the country or this part of the country? Do we give them to old people or everybody? Right? It's a classic problem of shortages, and how do we allocate the resources? Well, the normal way of doing this is the CDC has some maps, and they color code them, and they say, Iowa is red. Right, code red in Iowa. Let's get some things up to Iowa. The problem is, it's a sort of Soviet-style command and control method for doing a problem analysis. There's some pinheaded bureaucrats down in Atlanta who process all this information and come up with these color-coded maps. And by the time they issue their report, well, 10,000 people have already died of the flu. And you get the report, and you're like, well, thank you. That was 3 weeks old. I need to know what's going to be happening tomorrow. And lots of people, doctors, nurses, people in clinics and barbershops, have an idea about the prevalence of the flu, school nurses and teachers, but they have no way to reveal that information. You're a teacher, you see lots of kids are absent from school. What, are you going to call up the governor and say, hey, there's lots of kids missing from school. I think there may be a flu problem. We should allocate resources, right? That doesn't happen. So the Iowa electronic markets, who do these prediction markets for elections, came up with a method. They give market participants cash to bet on flu forecasting. And what they're doing is they're predicting the color of the map that the CDC is going to issue too late. So the CDC issues a map 2 weeks late, and what I'm doing is betting on what color the map's going to be. And surprise, they do a better job, they do a very, very good job at predicting what the color of the map is going to be, and better than any other forecasting method. And what do they get in return? Well, this is just doctors. The doctors get some Iowa flu dollars, which is the equivalent of some trivial grants of money. But really, and as the experience with prediction markets in a variety of contexts shows, it doesn't really matter what you give people. You can give people coffee mugs. Google runs these for innumerable things in predicting things about their company and its competitors, and they have a rank listing of the top performers. And that's all it takes, right? We humans are egoists by nature, and I just want to distinguish myself from this guy, right? That's all that really it takes. Now, in some instances, you might have to prime people with money, but by and large, you don't. Okay, so what could we do? Well, first of all, we might want to say, what's the crime rate going to be? So we float a contract. It pays $1 if some Chicago crime index, this is a statistic put out by the FBI, identical to the flu map that the CDC puts out, is between some number, say 5,100 and 5,200 crimes per 100,000 people, and it pays zero otherwise. And we do this for a whole range of expected values of the crime index, and then we have people trade them. We have police officers. We have people in politicians. We have academic criminologists. We let the people on the street trade them. Well, what does this reveal? First of all, it reveals which of these is the most likely outcome, and it also gives us this wonderful thing called a distribution, which gives us the range of outcomes. So back to our example of non-farm payrolls. This was a prediction market run on non-farm payrolls. And you can see, bless you, that the most likely prediction was in here, right? About 11.7% likely that that would be the number. But that doesn't really tell you what you really want to know, which is what's the range? A forecaster wants to know not just what the average is, but what the whole distribution and the likely tails are going to be. And so this shows the expectation, and then also there's huge uncertainty, right? If this distribution looked like this and had the same average, it would be misleading to just report the average. You'd want to know the comparison between the two. Okay, so this is something that prediction markets can do. Okay, practical example. A city's trying to allocate police forces between three parts of the city, north, center, and south. It floats a prediction market and says, this pays $1 if the crime rate rises 10% in the north and zero otherwise, and then has a bunch of these for each of those ranges and then in each part of the city. Police then could compare across different parts of the city. Say the market thinks crime's going to rise in the north, so we should allocate police to the north. Okay, we're all Chicago law students here, so you can obviously see there's a huge problem with this. Traders are going to know that the police are going to respond to this, right? If the prediction market believes there's a 10% likely increase in the north, then the police are going to allocate more resources to the north, and therefore, when the prediction market unwinds, when it's resolved, lo and behold, the statistics will show there's been no change in the north. Markets are going to know this, so markets may therefore underestimate from the perspective of police. From the police, so they might say, we expect a 5% rise, when they don't mean we expect a 5% rise. They mean we expect a 10% rise in criminality, but a 5% response by the government. So, depending on our views about the elasticity of the policymaker's response, it's going to bake in differences in the market prices for these markets. Okay? So we run a market that says, what's the change going to be assuming there's no change in policing? Would this work? Well, maybe. But the problem is that this market's going to reveal, The problem is the market is going to ask the question of itself, what change is going to lead policymakers to no change? What conditions on the ground are going to result in the police not changing their policy? And so the market is going to estimate not what you want it to estimate, but instead only going to give you information when current conditions are likely to lead to no policy change. Okay, so this leaves us with a classic problem that economists face all the time, and it's called simultaneity, right? We've got a series of simultaneous equations. What we want to know is what the crime rate is going to be. That's the underlying crime minus some policy response, so 10% rise but a 5% policy response. The policy response of the government is not going to just be the prediction market. They're going to do these other forecasting methods too. That's this first part, right? Some underlying criminality plus an error term, and this is the traditional forecasting plus some prediction market forecasting. The price, however, of the prediction market is going to include, right, the estimate of the crime rate conditional on this. But this is a component of the first equation. We have to solve these things simultaneously. So there's some ugly math here, right? We come up with this equation, which doesn't mean anything to anybody. The bottom line, it's in the appendix of the paper for those of you who are really pointy heads. What this tells us is that even in every conceivable scenario, prediction markets will reveal useful information to policymakers. Unless policymakers respond with an infinite number of monkeys, an infinite number of resources, right? Prediction markets will yield valuable information. So, prediction markets don't have perfect foresight. Policymakers respond with traditional estimates as well as prediction market estimates. And prediction markets know all this, so they will bake into their calculations the expected policy response. So, if you are a policymaker, you should just know this response. And you should establish a policy that's very clear. Here's how we will respond to your prices, you the market. The market will then know that to bake that into their calculations. And then when you, the policymaker, unbake this thing, you need to know that you should unbake it with your information that you gave to the market, right? So you expect, the market says, the crime is going to rise by 10%, but the mayor has announced a policy about how they'll respond. The market then says it's going to rise 3%, and the mayor should then say, but that really means 10%. Right? And the math we have in the paper shows how to do this. This is a very common problem, and economists do this all the time. This is how the Fed sets interest rates. Right? It announces a policy with respect to inflation, tells the market, these are our goals for inflation, just like our goals for criminality. And then the market basically tells the Fed what they should do with interest rates, and the Fed does that with interest rates, right? It's a fixed point equilibrium. Okay. Let me quickly talk about, so that's crime rates. Let me talk quickly about crime policy. There's a couple of things that you could do in crime policy which I think are interesting. Does the death penalty deter crimes and homicides? So we see a study that says, we look at state legislation and moratoria and homicide rates, and the 23 states that issued moratoria showed increases in homicide rates. Does this mean that the death penalty deters? Right, we saw an increase in homicides after states issued moratorium. Lots of studies, lots of academics look at data like this and come to the conclusion that yes, it does, or no, it doesn't. Well, there's no causation here. Politics behind moratoria and the underlying influence of the homicide rate might be driving this. These two things could be driven by some other factor that we don't know what it is, and we just don't have it in our models. So we could not say with any clarity that there was any causation here. So what can we do? Well, we run a prediction market on homicide rates. We have that operating in the background. And then we see a moratorium happen, and we look at an event study that says what happens to the market prices for predicting the future number of homicides when a moratorium happens. If the price for a specific homicide rate, say a 500, rises after a moratorium, this suggests that the market believes the moratorium will result in more murders, and therefore, again, the market believes that the death penalty deters. The problem with this, of course, is the market may already believe that a moratorium is likely. Event studies are hard to unpack the confounding time leading up to the moratorium. So there's some possibility of a moratorium already baked into the price. So what can we do to solve that problem? Well, we run two markets. One on Illicit homicide rates, and then another one on what's the probability that Illinois issues a moratorium on the death penalty. Again, a little math, but the difference is basically the causal effect can be determined by the change in the crime forecast, that's this one, divided by the probability that a moratorium is adopted. So, on the announcement, if the homicide rate rises 10 percentage points and the assessment of a moratorium rises 70 percentage points, then the market believes that the homicide rate will increase by 14 percentage points from a moratorium. So linking two parallel markets asking different questions that are related can give us a better insight into causation. It's really hard, though, to get, again, clean policy shocks because, let's say, a new governor comes in and she is both in favor of a moratorium but also likely to be soft on crime. And so her election will reduce, the police's ability to beat criminals into submission and make confessions. And that's likely to have some impact. And it's hard to unpack those two things. Okay, so what we can do is run some contingent markets. So we've got the new governor of Illinois. She's considering a moratorium. The normal approach for her is ask experts, ask her advisors. But her advisors may not have access to the best information, so what could she do? She could float four contracts. There's a death penalty moratorium, and homicide rates are higher than today. That pays a dollar if true. Death penalty moratorium and homicide rates are lower than today, and exactly the opposite. No death penalty moratorium, and rates are higher or lower. And have the market trade in these contracts. And then we want to compare whether these, the death rates, the homicide rates, are lower with or without the death penalty. Some very simple math. And so let's say this one is trading at 60, 20, 30, and 70, these markets. And then we just compare the probability that homicide is lower with no death penalty, right? We do the division, simple division, and it's 0.25. Homicide is lower with the death penalty, 0.75. These four contract prices suggest the market is very, very, very confident the death penalty is a deterrent. Another option, she could float two contracts. Let's call them Class A and Class B contracts. Class A pays a dollar for each homicide, but doesn't pay out if there's no death penalty. And Class B pays only if there is a death penalty. And the difference between these two prices is the estimate of the causal effect of the death penalty on homicide rates. And we could do this not just on the death penalty, but anything. Increased policing, different sentence lengths, the use of rehabilitation and drug treatment programs. And just so we're clear, there's no ideological motive behind this kind of approach. My co-authors and I, Justin Wolfers from Penn and Eric Zitzowitz from Dartmouth, surely don't agree about criminal law sentencing policies. I know when I sat in your shoes in criminal law, I had a very hard time in that class because I couldn't understand any of the rules. I just wanted all those people to go to prison for the rest of their lives. But that doesn't have anything to do with this. Because if you're one of those people who believes, say, for example, that politicians prey on the insecurities of people, and public safety is something that they could always use as a trump card to get more and more resources for the government and to infringe on people's civil liberties, then you should be really in favor of this, because this doesn't allow politicians to do this. When politicians say, we have to beef up policing to make people safe, the market can call BS, right? It can sanity check either one side of the ideological spectrum or the other about whether or not policing decisions or policy decisions are sensible. Okay, there's some other potential markets. I want to move on to try to get to questions. Let me just show you quickly, again, this goes to the distribution. The distribution, this is the result, say, of continuing the death penalty and the homicide rate and eliminating the death penalty. We could run two parallel markets, and then by Bayes' rule, deconvolute these to get at what the implied effect is, which is just this, right? This is just basically the difference between these two. And what we end up with is a distribution of the likely effect of the homicide rate from the change in the death penalty. We know what the average is, but we want to know what these tails are too, right? So the existing literature, all it does is use point estimates. This recent paper, they take 3,000 counties for this giant period of time, and they conclude by looking, running time series and all these very advanced statistical methods, that yes, each execution by the government of alleged criminals results in 18 saved lives. 18 saved lives per execution? Cass Sunstein and Adrian Vimont read this and other studies like it, and they say it's a moral imperative that we kill people, going back to my Agatha submerged in the tub, right? It's a moral imperative that we use the death penalty. Well, really? Is it? First of all, we could doubt the methodology, but averages don't really tell us what we want to know, right? Let's say there's an increase, an impact of 10 homicides from a death penalty moratorium, and you might think, nationwide, 10 homicides, that's a small price to pay for living in a country where we don't have the death penalty, so we can be more like France. It's a small price to pay, 10 dead people. But a policymaker might want to know, well, maybe the distribution's really flat, or there's a big tail that suggests, hey, there's a 1% chance that this moratorium could lead to 500 homicides. That's what the market believes, right? Averages are like, remind you of the story of the guy who drowned, but his average depth was only 3 inches, right? The average doesn't really tell us much. We want to know about the tails, be they thin or fat. Okay. Going towards establishing causation with these markets, we want to look at exogenous shocks to policy. So a Supreme Court ban on capital punishment would give us this. We've got states with no death penalty, we've got states with death penalty. The Supreme Court comes out and says, no death penalty. We can look at changes in homicide rates in those states, and that would tell us whether or not this has a effect. The problem is that these are hard to come by. The Supreme Court gave us one of these in 1972, but we can't expect them in the future. And even if we got one, it may dispositively answer the question that we're asking. Once the Supreme Court says no more executions, no more executions. Prediction markets allow us to create synthetic shocks. We can ask the markets what would happen if the Supreme Court did this. Remember the contingent markets about Obama and the number of troops in Iraq. So pay $1 for each percentage point rise in the homicide rates in current death penalty states, but only if the Supreme Court rules the provision unconstitutional. And then the other, right, in non-death penalty states. And then the differences between these two are going to give us some estimate of the causal impact. So prediction markets allow us to play forward the future and allow us to estimate the impacts of policy that may be very costly to implement. Okay, so this is just some math. Very simple, gives us a very clean way of estimating using market probabilities. We probably think there's under-experimentation in policy because politicians are afraid if they make changes and deviate from the status quo, let's say we dramatically lower drug sentences. But then there might be an increase in crime and politicians would be held responsible. So things get stuck and the status quo gets stuck. And markets allow us to estimate or give policymakers another tool for estimating impacts without running the fear, having the fear of bad consequences. Okay, I have some more things to say about design issues, but I'm going to stop there. You can look at these slides if you want to. I've talked for too long, and I want to hear questions that people have. Yes?
How do you anticipate getting over the ick factor? Like, I'm imagining you holding your winning contract that there was 500 homicides, a total woman crying, saying that man just made money off of it.
Yeah, so there is this sort of this idea, a horrible, pernicious, must be eradicated idea, that people shouldn't profit from other people's wrongdoing or other people's suffering. our entire civilization is premised on this. So, for example, we didn't say to the people who shorted Morton Thiokol stock that they should that profit that they made because the Challenger blew up and then the price went down, that those people should give up those profits. Absent some claim that they caused the Challenger to blow up to profit. That is, they manipulated. Right? I go and sell short General Motors stock, and then I plant some C4 in General Motors' main factory and blow it up. Right? There's a yik factor there. But not if what we're doing is providing valuable information, right? And we don't have any causation with the number of murders. So, for example, plea bargaining, right? We're effectively paying criminals to reveal information to us, right? This is no different than plea bargaining in the sense that criminals should be allowed to trade in these markets. After all, they've got the best information, right? So criminals are paid in this market to reveal information that they otherwise have just because they're criminals. And we pay them to give it to us. Now, if it comes to the point where we figure out that in one of these markets we're subsidizing criminals who are profiting by manipulating the markets, that's a different story. Manipulation is very, very hard to do in these markets. And there are other forces moving to try to prevent criminals. So it's not like you think, okay, there's a small money market run by the Chicago Police Department where I could get a reputation for being a very good predictor of crime rates, and I might earn a couple $100 so I could buy Chicago Police Department souvenirs. Oh, and I'm going to go kill somebody to make the murder rate higher and risk getting the death penalty to get the coffee mug. Yeah, it's hard to spin that story out.
How does the model deal with taking into account different risk practices?
Say more?
Well, so you say that people can bet different amounts based on their confidence in their estimate, the information they have. What if you have someone that's really confident, but they just happen to be a not risky person? So they, is that all baked in the confidence?
Well, there may be someone who otherwise would be, a very powerful force in a deliberation. Right, so we sit 10 experts down, and they're going to stand up and pound the table, but they're very squeamish about spending their own money. I think that's the person you're talking about. I mean, one possibility with that is, again, you make the stakes very low. You make the stakes based on things like reputation. If your market is mostly, say, academic criminologists, reputation and bragging rights is a very powerful thing. The companies that use these, France Telecom, Google, HP, Dow, you name it, everybody's deploying these for various purposes. Their major source of motivation is just a leaderboard, right? Bragging rights. We don't think people are risk averse about bragging rights. Certain contexts, you might want to make the markets anonymous to give people, say, snitches on the street, the ability to snitch and trade in these markets without revealing who they are. And these design issues are things that we're probably only going to get through trial and error. Yeah. Yeah, so again, I mean, we talk about this in the paper. DARPA, this is the Defense Department sort of think tank, and full disclosure, my father-in-law works there, came up with a brilliant idea, which is to run a prediction market predicting future terrorist activities. Again, imagine you're the president, and you get these horrible national security briefings. Did you see this page they gave the Bush about weapons of mass destruction? And you're like, is that really the best information that we have? And you're relying on your advisors. George Tenet comes in and says, oh, it's a slam dunk. And, really? Is it a slam dunk? Right? And the president may be, depending on your political views, too dim-witted or just too far away, too high up in the clouds to be able to know the details of all these policies. You got Ahmed Chalabi saying that, they're going to welcome us with flowers. Should we believe him or not? He's got his own private motives. And markets are a good way of giving the president, right, a clear signal of what's the likelihood of some terrorist attack. The DARPA market, which was going to predict terrorist attacks, was dismantled largely because of this concern that, again, terrorists would, who otherwise don't want to hurt us, would be attracted by the possibility of earning a couple $100s in a terrorism's futures market, right? If terrorists have, let's say, a nuclear bomb, and instead of profiting in the terrorism market, they went and blew up Microsoft's headquarters, right? They got a really small nuclear bomb. This might be a good thing to you, you know, net freedom guys. But let's say they go and blow up Microsoft. Oh, and by the way, they shorted Microsoft stock massively. They could make billions versus a couple of $100 in a DARPA coffee mug in the terrorism market, right? So when I say this is something that needs to be eradicated and that I'm a free market fundamentalist, it's this kind of ick factor that we have to get over, because whatever ick factor there is, it's revealing. Yeah, that's a cost for sure, but the benefit of revealing information is incredibly high.
What evidence is there that the Chicago Police Department baseball hat and the DARPA coffee mug is a sufficient incentive to get the people who have the most valuable information, the people who live in crime-ridden neighborhoods or related to criminals, or maybe the criminals themselves, to reveal the information they have? What are they really interested in getting the Chicago Police Department?
Good, great question. Okay, so let's just start with the easy one, which is companies like Google, who have shown, and this is not the people on the south side who live in crime-ridden areas or the west side. Reputation works, coffee mugs, lottery tickets work at Google to get people to reveal information. Okay, and there are studies that Google has run. As you can imagine, these guys are data junkies, and I've talked to their head guy, Bo Calgill. They have incredible amounts of data that suggest this really works. Now, what do we do about people who live in crime-ridden neighborhoods? They're not going to want Chicago Police Department coffee mugs. So in the paper, we have a modest proposal. I'm just guessing. We have a modest proposal to prime one of these markets. The federal government should do this to get the legal question. There's legal questions about whether this is gambling. We need to get those out of the way. Federal government should sponsor one of these and put some amount of money into it and allow people to trade to get small returns. So maybe they fund one of these markets with $1 million. And you allow people to trade, so that some individual on the south side who really has really great information could earn a couple hundred, 500,000, something like that, dollars, which may be really important to them, but not important enough that you would want to go out and manipulate and kill a bunch of people to get your prediction to come true. Okay. In addition, there's a benefit of these markets which really has nothing to do with whether you're rewarded, and that is the central locus for processing information. So if I think crime's going to be going up in my neighborhood, and I call up the mayor's office and I say, hey, mayor, I think crime might be going up in my neighborhood, the mayor, you know, this is just noise in the station house. The mayor's not going to listen to you. So just giving people, it's like, you know, you could just give people a telephone number, and I'm sure the police have this to report incidents, but they're overwhelmed by that. They don't know whether this is true or someone snitching on their neighbors, right? So just having the centralized location for people to go and trade on the information and feel like they're contributing could go a large way. But I do agree with you. I think money could be necessary. You could use small amounts of money. Small amounts of money in people who have, in companies that have used this, prove very effective. Yeah.
You said that these markets don't care who you are, but don't they care the value of the trade at, so that if you care about the resources you have, that process would be less accurate and there's any way to
do
that?
Okay, so good questions. If we let people bet their own money, then we might think, you know, I don't know, rich white guys are going to somehow run the market, right? And the people who don't have really good information are going to be left out. There's ways we could solve that, right? People who have not a lot of money still play in the stock market. People pool their money together, right? So the Rainbow Push Coalition could pool people together and allow people to bet on, you know, bet on margin. I mean, there's all sorts of mechanisms that public markets for things like stocks use. But a better approach would be for a market like this, give people, endow people with a set amount. So the Iowa flu dollars, they just gave all these doctors the same amount. Every dollar got 100 chits to use. And then the only way to get more credits, more cash in your bank, was to do a good job. So if you give everybody that's participating in these markets $100 of play money to play, then people can bet according to their confidence and then according to how well they're doing. Right? We want to reward people who get good information.
Part of the law that Edward mentioned is not about the person who's actually doing the crime, it's about people who have information and otherwise give it freely. So not positive in the typical legal sense. I'm thinking in this case like the Challenger example. Someone who may have known or guessed that the O-ring was faulty and knew there was potential problems, sells the company shares short, but doesn't get paid unless there's some kind of test. In no way is it legally culpable for the destruction of the Challenger, but may have given the information freely without the market. So what, how do you respond to that kind of thing?
So I'm not sure exactly how that would play out in this context. So there's someone who
has a gun and may be going to rob a liquor store, and you don't tell anyone. You'd rather you go to the computer and try to make some money.
Okay, so I think there's an important thing here. So first of all, for situations like, you know, you see someone on their way to rob a liquor store, something that happens to me on a daily basis, it's unlikely this is going to affect the kinds of crime policy questions, like the number of violent crimes in the city, to the point where you have no incentive to call. I mean, if you're the, you know, let's hope we're not in the Kitty Genovese world anymore of people just, you know, watch bad things happen and don't tell anybody. I think you still have an incentive on those marginal cases to tell people. But I think there's a false dichotomy in what you're saying, and that is, you know, you would otherwise have an incentive to tell people, but now you don't. Well, this is exactly the other way, right? Most people have no incentive at all to tell anybody about any crimes that are likely to happen or any change in criminality in their neighborhood, anything, because apathy, they have apathy, they may fear retaliation, right? And what's in it for them? Right? They probably think that there's no chance that anybody's going to respond to this information. Now someone said to me, I'm going to pay you for your information. Right? And so if we compare the state now, people who live on the west side of Chicago and their views about their neighborhood are changed, or doctors who see people come into the ER, or the cop on the beat who thinks, yeah, I could tell my sergeant, but it's not going to matter because the mayor is set on, you know, allocating all the resources to the north part of the city. Well, now he has an incentive to tell because the market's going to say that crimes are really going to be rising in the South, and it's going to make the mayor more politically accountable, right? The mayor can no longer just wave his hands and say, oh, there's nothing political about the way we respond to allocating police resources. This will hold them accountable.
Yeah.
What's the stop, I guess, kind of reversal was being talked about earlier, where criminals redeem the market. Let's say there's a North, a Central, and a South District, and they deem to make it seem as if there's going to be a crime in the North District, North, and commit a crime in the South. Kind of the George Soros effect in crime, where, you know, you gain it, you make it seem to go one way, or you achieve a more valuable effect.
Okay, so massive buying of violent crime rates in the North, just so I understand your question, to drive up the price of crime rates in the North, to send a signal to the mayor that they should allocate crime fighting to the North, and then open the South up for crime fighting. Okay. So, again, any attempts to manipulate markets are doomed to fail in the long run. Just, you don't take anything away from this, take that away from it. George Soros tried the same thing, and it does not work. And the reason it doesn't work is because this is called the honey that attracts the bears, right? The people who are stupid, that is, they don't have any information, they're just playing in the stock market. People actually today, believe it or not, go out and buy individual stocks. The Supreme Court just had to refuse to take an appeal because six sitting Supreme Court justices own individual stocks in companies. As far as I'm concerned, that fact alone should disqualify them from sitting in judgment of anybody about anything, because it shows they're idiots. Hello? Have you heard of portfolio theory, right? Right? So, so getting back to your point, just went off on a rant, sorry. Okay, back to your point. If you're an individual in the North, and you see that the price is rising dramatically, but you know, right, you're a cop on the beat, you know the situation in the North is great, you know the drug task force that's been deployed has no signs at all, and you see that the violent crime rate is expected to dramatically spike in the North, what are you going to do? You're going to sell the North, right? So the notion that markets can get so far out of whack and being manipulated by one group of individuals, small group of individuals, especially when the criminals can't in this market where everybody's allocated a set amount of money, it's not like they can pour all of their wealth into manipulation like the Bass brothers try to do in the silver markets, right? Or if movies are more your thing, trading places, not trading spaces, although she is back now, and it's improved back to where it was before, but it doesn't work. The attempts to corner markets do not work. There's no evidence in the history of humankind that that kind of strategy works. And I'm guessing the criminals would, if they fell prey to thinking that it did, people would just be able to profit at their expense, which is a good thing.
I was wondering about potential for institutional investors to farm in this market, because it seems like if they did farm, then they're likely to depend on the same kinds of experts that the government is already depending on, and they would have larger pools of capital. So if you really wanted to focus on people we usually think are noise traders, it would be the doctors or like the criminals and the policemen, and then these institutional investors come in, they're not going to hire the people with the special information. They're going to hire the same kinds of experts that the government is already
Okay, so your scenario you've laid out is such a doomsday that crime policy becomes to look more like the stock market than like the completely disorganized, completely inefficient, Soviet-style command and control system for processing information that we currently have in predicting crime? Okay, I'll concede the point. Because that would be, you know, a triple off the top of the wall. Maybe not the home run that I've envisioned. In addition, it seems like in the design of these things, and here we're sketching out the, you know, the 10,000-foot view, when you come to the actual design, and that's what these design issues about, are things like contractibility. How do you write contracts that will be very successful? Who do you decide whether they can trade or not? How do you generate enough liquidity in these markets? That's what the next like 10 slides are that I won't bore you with, but you can look at or read the paper. Those issues are things that are only going to be determined through trial and error in running these markets. So maybe you have some system where you ban institutional investors, whatever flavor they would look like, right? Only individuals can trade and not through intermediaries. I don't know. We can imagine lots of potential permutations. Yeah.
How fast does the accuracy of these markets fall off as the time horizon gets longer? Like, I imagine the Iowa flu market is really great 2 weeks before the CUC report, but 6 months ahead of time may be just as good as flipping a coin. And if the accuracy is really dependent on the time horizon, then how useful are the markets, you know, just in terms of deploying resources?
Great question. It's going to be highly dependent, if you go back to those equations, that X, which was the underlying crime factors, what is it that's driving criminality, if that's what you're estimating as crime rates? Whatever those things are and whatever the lead times are unknown to me, right? So it could be that some things that you're predicting are going to be like Iowa, where you only know 2 weeks in advance, right? But I bet the police would tell you for a lot of stuff, they just need 24 hours notice, right? So maybe something like the death penalty, something like sentencing rates. Again, it's unknown to me. There is going to be an attenuation the further you get away in time on some things, the less information you're going to get. But again, we want to be able to compare it to the current methods for forecasting and not some, you know, perfect nirvana. Yeah.
Don't we kind of already know in Chicago where we need to put resources? Like in the South or the West or something like that. Don't we necessarily need to get more specific than just South or West, like almost like by neighborhood or by block, in which case the moral hazard might become more of a problem?
Okay, good. So my first response is the federal government is spending your money to produce reports. There's a 95-page report I have on my computer I'm happy to share with you where I took those graphs of the city with those colors. Right? There's an entire department within the Justice Department whose sole purpose is to improve crime forecasting. Okay, so my first response is people believe it's a problem. There are academics who spend their whole lives worried about this kind of thing. Right? And all we're doing is we're not saying no one's ever thought of this, and here's this new idea. We're saying people are thinking about it, but they forgot about my hero, F.A. Hayek. That's what we're suggesting. Okay, so that's the first response, is people believe it's a problem, people who know a lot more about it than I do. Okay. As it gets down to the granularity of block by block, this is no doubt becomes more in the moral hazard direction, and writing the contracts in ways that don't give rise to moral hazard problems is something that we're only going to get through experimentation and experience. So I know it's kind of the second answer is very lame. It's just a little bit further down the road, and I know my own limitations. I can't predict the best way to design these markets, the experiences that people are going to have. I can only sort of, you know, here I'm only laying out the big picture stuff. Yeah.
How do you get people up to level of sophistication necessary to trade in a market like this? I would think that, in high crime areas, trading a futures contract is not something that's, very easy for somebody to do. Additionally, the kind of high transaction costs of purchasing computers and stuff, it's very cheap for somebody to pick up a phone and say, I think some crime is going up in my area.
Fabulous question. Okay, first of all, just with respect to me and you, and most people of some means, the computer use is very high in the country. There are companies, not surprisingly, who exist to write software and user interfaces that are incredibly intuitive. So there's a company that I've worked with who they have designed these things so you don't even have to know that it's a market, right? They put that button from the Office Max or whatever that thing is, the easy button, right? It's like that, right? You can have a horse come in. It's just like there's a button under your desk and, you think someone's going to be, you just step on the thing, right? It's that simple. Okay, now with respect to people who we think might have a lot of information or, people with poor means, you can imagine along the lines of the institutional investors, devices whereby the city would set up mechanisms to get those people information, right? If you think crime's going to be up in your neighborhood, you can call or come up with some other sort of centralized location where you could communicate sort of through a broker, effectively, and the broker could be some government official. We have this 311 line in Chicago. You could blink it in through 311. So you'd call up and you'd say, what are people thinking is going to be happening? Crime going to be up or down? And people, they could, So you could imagine scripts for people. There's, I think, ways of overcoming that. But as my example with the economists who are predicting job growth suggests, we might not even have to go there. If all we did was have a system whereby the police, the politicians, academic criminologists, and some experts, 100 people traded, we'd get better information than we do today. Okay, so that's the last question. I have these slides, which I'm happy to share with people. There's a paper on this, and I'd be happy to talk and take people's questions afterwards. Thanks for coming.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.